I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Who pays what in Maryland when it comes to taxes? The Maryland Center on Economic Policy conducted a study of taxation for different income groups in the state, and the results might surprise you, or maybe not. Tax policy and who pays what is the subject of conversation this hour with Ben Orr, Executive Director of the Center. We'll also talk about President Obama's declaration that middle-class economics is a priority of his administration. Among his promises, expanded tax breaks for middle-class families and government-paid tuition for community college. To pay for that, the president vowed to raise taxes on the country's wealthier citizens while closing corporate tax loopholes. It's Midday Friday. Open phones after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Interesting program for you. Open phone lines in this hour to call in and talk about President Obama's State of the Union, specifically what he had to say about tax policy in the United States and the tax changes he's proposing. And also here in the state of Maryland, we're going to be hearing about who pays for what in Maryland. We have an analysis of taxation for different income groups in the state, and the results, as I said in the introduction, might surprise you, but then again, maybe not. Ben Orr, Executive Director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, will be with us in a few minutes to talk about that. In the second hour of our show today, I hope you'll stick around for this. We are profiling a Baltimore nonprofit called Thread. Thread, T-H-R-E-A-D, that's its name. And people have been telling me now for the last year, you've got to get Sarah Heminger on your show. She runs Thread. This is an intense operation that she started in 2014, all volunteers, intensely focused on at-risk high school freshmen in Baltimore City, the bottom 25% of achieving students in three schools. And the ratio of volunteers to students, mentors to students, is 8-to-1 in this program, Thread. And they have quite a story to tell after being in operations for 10 or 11 years now. So Sarah Heminger from Thread joining us in the second hour of our show. Up front, we want to get commentary from Richard Striner and welcome him back to the show. Richard Striner, professor of history at Washington College, author and presidential historian from time to time, joins us from Chestertown to give his perspective on the news of the week. And we asked Richard to focus specifically on President Obama and his State of the Union here in 2015. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Dan.
Well, we heard what the president had to say Tuesday night and the reaction to it. First question for Richard Striner, one of three. Can President Obama really get anything done with this new Congress?
It'll be interesting to see. It's certainly possible. It's useful to compare Obama's presidency and Clinton's presidency in the 1990s. There were differences, but some similarities as well. Both of them suffered a major reverse midway through their first term. The Republican contract with America won the Republicans control of both houses of Congress in 94. The Tea Party revolt gave the Republicans the House in 2010. Both got reelected to a second term after that reverse. In Clinton's second term, he was able to achieve, notwithstanding the distraction of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, some significant bipartisan legislation on a number of items that compare to the sorts of things that Obama was suggesting. You could call them small scale in some ways, no-brainers in some ways, practical measures that most Americans would probably support. In Clinton's case, tightening meat inspection standards after some tainted food scandals, legislation to do a better job of interstate tracking of child molesters, you know, that sort of thing. Some of the things that Obama proposed are quite comparable. But the politics are different because in the 90s, there was a big backlash against right-wing Republican excesses in the contract with America as early as 1995. And by Clinton's second term, a lot of Republicans were scrambling away from the extreme right. Today, it depends upon how the politics play out between mainstream Republicans versus Tea Party Republicans. And they're naturally wondering and worrying about what kind of a presidential candidate they're going to have in 2016.
Just in the last couple of weeks, we've heard a very populist message from President Obama, not only in the State of the Union address, but he showed up in Baltimore last week pushing for paid sick leave. Prior to that, he was proposing free community college. And then we have his tax the wealthy plan that he proposed Tuesday night. Does this populist appeal from Obama, particularly on taxes, set the stage for 2016?
It certainly could set the stage, but here, too, it depends upon, you know, who the candidate turns out to be and how populistic that candidate may be, just as there is tension on the right between mainstream Republicans and Tea Party Republicans, there's tension on the left within the Democratic Party between Democrats who want to set an angrier tone on wealth inequality and those who are not so much inclined to do that. I'm an independent, but I have to say that in my own view, there's a lot of relearning that has to take place on the left with regard to the politics of class inequality. Some Republicans have called Obama's proposal class warfare. Others on the left say the class warfare really started with the super wealthy, you know, imposing all sorts of things on everybody else. And then people like the Koch brothers being able to drag a red herring across that trail by getting disaffected people at the grassroots blaming government instead of class inequality. I'll be very interested to see how the Democrats play that.
Presidential historian Richard Schreiner, what is President Obama's legacy beginning to look like to you?
Well, here again, I make the comparison between Obama and Clinton. There are many striking differences between the two men. Obama being far more self-controlled, calm, steady, than some of the more impulsive things that Bill Clinton did that got him into trouble. Mm-hmm. But in other ways, the legacies are eerily similar. Both of them started off with an economic issue, a need for economic stimulus in their first year. Bill Clinton's was filibustered to death. Obama got his through, but some, like Paul Krugman, say it wasn't enough, and I agree with that. Healthcare came up in the second year of the first term. The Clintons, Bill and Hillary, didn't get anything through. Obama did. The comparison is starting to look pretty good, but again, midway through that first term, major reverse, and unlike Clinton, who through skill and luck to some extent was able to salvage something in his second term, remains to be seen whether Obama will be able to salvage much of anything. By my standards, he was not sufficiently audacious in his first year, and he lost control of things and was all downhill after that. I hope for his sake that he is able to salvage something.
Richard Schreiner, historian, professor of history at Washington College. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for your commentary. Richard Schreiner joins us from time to time here on the Midday Show, especially on Midday Fridays. Now we turn to Ben Orr and welcome him to the studio, executive director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. And before that, he was with the organization in its previous name, Maryland Budget and Tax Policy Institute. Nice to have you on the show with us, Ben.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Any thoughts about President Obama's proposals first before we take a look at Maryland and taxes? What the president specifically outlined Tuesday night.
Yeah, I think it was a really interesting proposal that he put forward, part of a package, like you said, of these populist kind of ideas, paid sick leave. He was actually here around the corner from our studio here.
Charmington's.
Talking about paid sick leave and his proposals on community college. I think it's for our purposes today, I wanted to focus on the tax components. And, you know, and he President Obama had eight components to his tax plan in the State of the Union address. And I think there are two that have particular implications for Maryland, particularly in the context of maybe not being able to get these through Congress. Very quickly, the eight components that Obama proposed were to close loopholes. Tax loopholes that benefit trusts, perhaps by taxing them upon inheritance. Otherwise, those gains are not taxed at all right now. That tax on that income is forgiven. He proposed returning the top capital gains tax to the rate it was in during the Reagan administration.
It's 28%?
28% was what it was during Reagan's administration.
It's down. What now, Ben? 23 or something?
It's about 23%. That's right. Maryland also has its own capital gains tax that's 5.8% on top of that. He also called for reforming financial sector taxation by imposing fees on excessive liabilities so that banks don't overextend themselves, you know, thinking about the causes of the Great Recession,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm.
He called on Congress to create a new tax credit for two-earner families making over under $210,000 to help those additional costs when that second parent goes to work. He called for consolidating and improving education tax incentives, particularly the Opportunity Tax Credit.
That's the one for higher education?
Right,
that's
exactly.
The one that's been around for a little while now, the American Opportunity Tax Credit. That came out of this administration, right? That was a tax benefit for higher education, I believe, right?
So it is a tax credit for higher education. I have to admit, I'm not actually sure which when that tax credit started.
I think it came in under Obama.
It definitely has been a focus of his, and as a route to opportunity.
I don't want to, you know, you went past the expand middle and low income family tax credits. I mean, you mentioned it.
I do. Yeah.
Is that the one you wanted to focus on today?
I do. You know, President Obama also called for encouraging workers to save for retirement. But there were these two components, and you're exactly right. The expanding the earned income tax credit for childless workers was one component, and the final component was to triple the child care tax credit. I think these two components really have some implications for Maryland. There are some steps that Maryland can take, even in the absence of action at the federal level, to help working families. You know, here in Maryland, we have a state earned income tax credit. We expanded it last year.
Tell people what that's meant to do.
Sure.
Who it's meant to help.
So the idea is the earned income tax credit only goes to those folks who are working and have an income. And the idea is that it helps them get over the hurdle of entering the workforce. There are some costs that you don't have normally. Maybe you have to buy a new wardrobe for your job. Maybe you have additional transportation costs that you didn't have before. And the idea is that it helps people who are at the low end of the income scale get back into the workforce. You know, maybe you have childcare benefits that you didn't have before because you were able to take care of your child directly since you weren't working.
I've heard people describe it as one of our strongest anti-poverty tools.
It absolutely is. It really is, I think, along with Social Security, to one of the most successful anti-poverty programs we have in this country. And really, you know, it's money that goes back into people's pockets. And not only does it go into their pocket, but then they turn around and spend it in their local economy.
What's the other one you wanted to talk about?
So Obama called for Congress to triple the child care tax credit. And here in Maryland, we have a child care subsidy. You know, it's incredible the cost of child care here in Maryland. In almost all Maryland communities, average annual child care costs are greater, they're more expensive than tuition and fees at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Say that again.
In almost every jurisdiction in Maryland, the average cost of child care is greater than the cost of a year of tuition and fees at UMBC.
Which is what, for in-state, like under $12,000 or something like that? $8,000 to $10,000, something like that?
Okay. I'm trying to
if
pull
you don't have the number,
I don't have the number handy.
But you know, that's the conclusion. That's the conclusion you reach.
That's the conclusion we reach. Even after, and I'll say this, even after the mid-year tuition increase that students just saw here in January.
Yeah, that's another thing. We haven't even had time to talk about that. That was just past last week, wasn't it? Within
that's
the last
right.
10
that's
days.
Right.
All right, Ben, why don't you sit right there? Ben Orr from the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. We're also going to take a look at the tax picture here in Maryland. By the way, open phone lines if you want to talk about President Obama's proposals, Larry Hogan's budget. There's another thing we'll talk about a little bit with the new governor in Maryland, what he has proposed in his budget that's being presented to the General Assembly today. 410-662-8780 is our number. Should I do that one more time? 410-662-8780, because we'd like to hear from you. Open phone lines in this hour, and you can ask questions of Ben Orr, too. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday Friday with open phones to talk about taxation and economic policy here in the state and in the nation. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. I already have a couple emails to read on this subject. And Ben Orr is with me, Executive Director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. And in Ben's organization, along with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, took a hard look at state and local taxes in Maryland to answer the question, who pays what? And the who being the different income groups in the state and what their overall rate of taxation is, right? State and local taxes. And Ben, when we talk about taxes in this study, that's income tax, property tax,
sales tax,
excise tax, all those taxes, right?
That's right.
You looked at everything.
That's right. And some of the credits that you can get on those taxes. That's absolutely right.
Okay. All right. So you included credits as well to arrive at these conclusions.
Yes.
So let's go through it. Let's look at the how should we do this? By the way, folks, if you go to my Facebook page, you can see this chart that Ben's going to describe. Why don't we start at the top and compare the top to the bottom? Maybe the top 1%, since we're always talking about the 1% in this country now. A lot of focus on that group. Go ahead.
Sure.
And maybe compare that to the bottom 10 or 20%.
Yeah. When we look at Maryland state and local taxes, what we find is that Maryland taxpayers in the middle, those making between $44,000 and $67,000, pay the most. As a share of their income, they pay 10.3% of their income in state and local taxes. We ask a little less of those at the bottom 20%, those making less than $24,000 a year. We ask them to contribute 9.7% of their income in state and local taxes.
So they pay a little bit less than those in the middle. And by the way, this is family income for non-elderly taxpayers. Right?
That's correct. Okay. So it's taxpayers under the age of 65, and families can be single individuals in this case. They can be families are all sorts of different sizes, but it is taxpayers under 65, which is the vast majority of taxpayers.
There's another group there, Ben, between those making less than $24,000. And those making less than $44,000, where are they in terms of taxes?
That's right. This sort of what we call the second quintile, or those, like you said, between $24,000 and $44,000 a year, they're at 9.5% in state and local tax. Of their income goes towards state and local taxes.
So small difference between what they're paying and the lowest 20% are paying.
Right. And I think actually if you look at this chart, I think what jumps out at me is actually, when we look at 80% of taxpayers, the bottom 80% of taxpayers, which is the vast majority of us, we're between 9.5% and 10.3% of our income goes towards state and local taxes. What's really interesting, though, is when we look at that top 20%, and in fact, when we break that down even further and look at the top 1%, here in Maryland, those at the top, the 1% of Maryland taxpayers making more than $481,000 pay just 6.7% of their income in state and local taxes.
They pay 3% overall less than people at the very bottom making under $24,000.
As a share of their income, they pay significantly less than 80% of Maryland taxpayers, including those at the very bottom.
Okay. The next group. The next 4% down, that's the group between $211,000 and that top group, $481,000, they're at 8.8. And then the next group down, the next 15%, between $111,000 per year and $211,000 per year, they're at 8.5%. So this is regressive, and maybe no one is surprised to hear that this situation exists here in Maryland. It exists throughout the country, does it not?
It does. In fact, we find that when we look at every single state in the country, every state's state and local tax system is regressive or asks more from those at the top, ask less of those at the top and ask more from those at the bottom.
How does Maryland compare to other states, would you say?
Interestingly, we come out a little bit better than most other states.
We're less regressive than other states?
Yes. It's hard to describe because it's almost a double negative, but we're 12th least regressive.
Twelfth least regressive. Yes. All right, so, I get what you're saying. How did we get here, though? Pardon my naive question, but I'd like to hear from you. What do you say about this when people from another country or from another planet look at this and say, wait a minute, this chart looks, this doesn't look right. Why are people who make under $24,000 a year paying overall 9.7% and people way up in the stratosphere of $481,000 up at only at 6.7%? How do you explain this to someone who's new here?
Well, it's a result of conscious choices we've taken that our lawmakers have taken. When we break out the components that make up the total state and local taxes, we can see where what are driving these numbers. So when we look at sales tax, for example, which makes up about a quarter of our state's budget, sales tax is very regressive. It falls most heavily on those who make the least. To our credit, we do exempt groceries from the sales tax, but overall, the sales tax is regressive. On the other hand, we have a progressive income tax. We have a higher rate of taxation for those who make more. Now, it's capped at the highest rate, I believe, is now
39?
Starts at it's no for the state. Income tax is 5.7%, and that is for families, joint households making more than $250,000. Maryland has the highest concentration of millionaires in the country. We have the highest median income, but we don't have any tax bracket above $250,000. One other component that really drives this is that you can deduct your federal taxes on your state return. And at the federal level, we have a very progressive taxation system, although, as President Obama talked about, we definitely could make some improvements, particularly around how we treat capital gains income, investment income. So those at the top of the income scale have a lot of federal tax a larger federal tax bill that they can deduct from their state and local taxes, which really drives down what they pay as a share of their income that they earn here in Maryland.
You know, you could also look at this and say, why do we have revenue shortfalls in Maryland? You can say, well, it's because we have Democrats in the legislature. Maryland will spend too much money, more than we have, more than we anticipate. But we had two revised projections come out this year from the state, and both showing, you know, revenue shortfalls for the current year and the coming year. And now Larry Hogan is the new governor, and we saw the budget that he proposed. It's going to the General Assembly today. But you look at this picture and the tax situation here, and you say, well, why do we have revenue shortfalls? Is it because of this chart?
I think this is definitely part of the story. You know, I mentioned a minute ago that about 25% of the budget is paid for through sales tax. Actually, 75 to 80% of the state's budget is paid for between the personal income tax and the sales tax. Those are the taxes you and I pay. Those are the taxes that are primarily reflected in this chart. And so we have a somewhat unbalanced tax system that doesn't ask more of those who have benefited most from our state's economy. This is one of the reasons why we have a shortfall. There are other reasons. We certainly are still working through the effects of the Great Recession. Needs are still very high relative to where they were, say, in the 90s. And we also are impacted by what's happening down in Washington. Not only are we going through sequestration, just like every other state is, but sequestration particularly impacts Maryland. Maryland's economy is particularly involved with the federal government.
And but we're in the second or third year of that now, aren't we?
We are, although, you know, it's interesting, sequestration has only been partially implemented. We've kind of put off full sequestration, but full sequestration is coming and will impact Maryland even more. I think we also have a lot of uncertainty. One of the reasons why we've been writing down our revenue estimates is that there's a lot of uncertainty in what is going to happen at the federal level, not only with, we sort of know the broad strokes of sequestration, but not so much the details in any given year. And also, I think people are very much wondering what this new Republican Congress is going to do in terms of the country's budget and how that will impact Maryland and to some extent Virginia as well.
It's hard to imagine this Congress going along with any of President Obama's proposals when it comes to taxes. However, he very smartly focused some of these proposals on middle class families and getting tax breaks into that group. So I wonder, I'd like to hear from our listeners today. Do you just assume, in listening to the president Tuesday night, looking at the scene here in Maryland with a new Republican governor, do you just assume that we're kind of stuck with the things the way they are in terms of who pays what, not only in Maryland, but in the United States, and in terms of our tax structure? President Obama talking about taxing the wealthiest Americans a little bit more in order to pay for his community college plan and to provide tax breaks for middle-class families. Do you think that's a nowheresville? We'd like to hear from you. Do you think it's a good idea? 410-662-8780 is our phone number here for Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Dan Roderick's along with Ben Orr, who is Executive Director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, taking a look at the tax picture here in Maryland. And I'm sure a whole bunch of people appreciate the work that you did to put into this, but say, you know, that just doesn't surprise me. This is, we know things are out of whack. They don't make sense, but that's the way it is. The annual cost of child care in Maryland can exceed the cost of sending a kid to college. This is from your own report from a couple years ago, right, mm-hmm. Ben? So I found this information for you, where our producer did. For an infant, child care center costs average $12,950 in 2013, far exceeding the $10,068 that the state of Working Maryland 2013. I'm sorry, that didn't make any sense. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, it was $12,950 in 2013. So that That's far right. exceeds, according to this report, as you were saying before, undergraduate tuition and fees at UMBC.
That's right, and one of the other figures we had in that report, the State of Working Maryland, 2013, is that families, particularly in Baltimore City, spend a tremendous percentage of their income on child care. In Baltimore City, it can be up to 30% of their income can go towards child care. So it can be a real burden for families.
We made reference to the Larry Hogan budget here, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. So I'm going to read this email from Jonathan, who has a comment and a question about it. Can we move on to that subject, too?
Sure.
You okay with that, Ben? Throughout the campaign and afterwards, writes Jonathan, Larry Hogan presented the state's budget shortfall as a crisis. It is $700 million out of an approximate $40 billion annual budget. That is a 1.7% shortfall. I make $44,000 per year working for the state. If I had a shortfall of 1.7%, I would have put $748 on a credit card this year. I can assure you that I put more than $748 on my credit cards this year. For Larry Hogan to misrepresent the budget shortfall as a crisis and then ask state employees who have already been denied cost of living increases for 5 years to bear the brunt of the cuts is disingenuous and insulting. I am absolutely livid about this budget proposal and will be attending every lobby day at the State House until the governor can honor the contract with state employees. The governor said he's going to stay steady at a 2% cut, right? That's basically what we got from the budget.
Yeah, so the governor has, as expected, introduced a budget that was focused entirely on balancing the budget through cuts. He has proposed another 2% cut on across the board on top of the cuts that the Board of Public Works made recently. And as Jonathan mentions, part of where these cuts are coming from is that state workers will once again be asked to take no cost of living adjustment, increase in their incomes, and likely to pay higher costs for their benefits. And as he said, that this has been something that's been locked. They've been locked in at the same income for something like 5 years. You know, I think it's interesting the way that Jonathan framed that, he let us know he works for the state. He makes, I think you said, $44,000. He's part of this group that pays the most as a share of their income in Maryland state and local taxes. He's the average taxpayer, and in that middle group. And when we look at the budget as proposed, we don't have a tremendous amount of detail because all we have is the press conference from yesterday and some supporting documents. We get the full budget today, and we'll have more information in the next week or so. But what
when he calls it a crisis, I mean, he's concerned about this. We've been here before. Ehrlich was here.
Absolutely.
O'Malley was here. We've seen this before. So, Larry Hogan is saying that the state has been spending too much money while the economy has been flat. We can't continue to do that. And he campaigned on that. So he's got to do something like this, right?
Right. So the state does face a shortfall of $741 million in the next budget year, fiscal year 16, which starts on July 1st of this year. But the caller is right. This is not, I would not necessarily categorize this as a crisis. We have consistently dealt with shortfalls like this over the past 10 years. We've faced much greater shortfalls to cover. I think during the O'Malley administration, we had shortfalls up to $1.7 billion. I think when he came into office at the beginning of the Great Recession, obviously there were a lot of external factors that created that shortfall in that moment. And I think the other thing that Jonathan kind of alludes to, but I think, if I as a family member am a little short, I might cut back spending some. I might borrow a little bit more. I might also find a second job, or I might find a way to increase my income, ask my boss for a raise, or put in more hours, or what have you. And I think the problem I have with the budget as introduced so far is that it really is an unbalanced approach to balancing the budget. What we really need is a balanced approach to balancing the budget that includes raising questions about how we tax our citizens. Going back to the chart we were discussing earlier, that we ask more of those in the middle and less of those at the top, those who have frankly benefited most from our great state of Maryland.
There's some $200 million in cuts to Medicaid proposed by the new governor, Larry Hogan. 410-662-8780 is a phone number here. We have open phone lines on midday if you'd like to talk about some of these issues. Ben Orr is our guest from the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. Before we go to this break, I'll take a quick call from Richard in Hagerstown. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point on the tax question that Ben was speaking about. I just am a little confused how taxing those at the top will create some sort of equality through the government. If there was a pipeline for wealthier Marylanders to pay more and it gets distributed to the bottom 80%, that would be one thing. But distributing it through the means of government, which we all know wastes tremendous amounts of money, I'm a little confused how government makes it more efficient and spends money more efficiently than individuals can do with their own money. And
okay. Well,
given
you sound like you don't like taxation. You don't think we should be taxing and providing services to people?
Nope, that's not what I said.
What would you eliminate, Richard? Tell me this. I'm curious. Where do you think government should not be involved where it is presently involved?
I didn't say that government shouldn't be involved. I think that government should shrink its size before we think that it spends efficiently money more than individuals can spend on their own.
Oh, okay.
That's the point of it. That's the whole thing, that individuals try to radicalize what is said. It's not that I'm saying that government shouldn't build roads and bridges and shouldn't pay teachers, and that's not the point that I was making, but government spends and wastes a tremendous amount of money. And taxing individuals more and creating a larger government doesn't necessarily give those at the bottom more money. It just gives politicians more money to hand out to special interests as opposed to giving it to the lower 80%.
Okay.
And so
all right, I get you.
That's the point I was making.
I just mentioned, you know, a proposed $200 million in cuts in Medicaid. That would affect the bottom 20% or 40% in this state. But anyway, you know, when someone brings up waste all the time, you know, I don't like to see waste in government either. But I like to see proof of waste. People assume that there is a lot of waste in government, that government spends money inefficiently versus, say, the private sector, which, of course, doesn't have any waste and is very lean and efficient all the time. But I'll let you comment, Ben.
You know, I think you pick up on an important distinction that I think that is important. You know, like any large organization, there will be inefficiencies. But I think people greatly overstate what those inefficiencies are. I think the other thing that this question brings to mind for me is I think there's this misperception that there are sort of two economies in Maryland, one with the private sector and one with the public sector, and that a job lost in the public sector doesn't harm Maryland's economy somehow. And so when we're talking about cuts to Medicaid, we're talking about cuts to healthcare for lower-income individuals, we're talking about cuts to reimbursement rates for doctors who are in the private sector. When we're talking about cuts to education so that there are more students in classrooms, teachers have larger classes to deal with. When we're talking about cuts to corrections so that prison guards have to deal with larger prisoner populations when we already know that they're vastly overworked and can't meet the standards that are set by you know, the Department of Justice and others. These have direct impacts on people's lives and on local economies. That prison guard, that school teacher, if they have a job, they go out and they turn around and spend that money in the local community. If they lose that job, they stop spending that money in the local community. Furthermore, we know that when high-income individuals either get a tax break, if we're talking about, say, the Bush tax cuts back in the first part of the century, if you get a tax break and you're making over $200,000 a year, you don't necessarily go spend that money in your local economy. You might buy a nice dinner in Baltimore City at one of our wonderful restaurants, or you might spend it on travel around the world, or you might put it into the stock market. It doesn't necessarily help the rest of us in our local economies because of the way that money is either spent or held on to.
Ben Orr from the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. This is Midday Friday. A short break. We'll come right back. 410-662-8780 is our number. Welcome back to Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. Let's go to the phone lines again. Ellen in Baltimore. You're on Midday. Hello.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Hi, Dan.
Yes. What did you want to say, Ellen?
Well, you know, when you're talking about the earned income tax credit, that is basically redistribution of income, right? Since most of the taxes are coming from the lower and middle classes, that means the lower and middle classes are basically, again, just like in Obamacare, subsidizing the poor. And that's just going to make them even more angry and more Republican. So, I mean, if you want to have redistribution of income, you know, it ought to be from the top, but nobody talks about this as a kind of redistribution of income from the middle class.
Well, Ellen,
poor.
Thank you. I mean, she has kind of a point there, doesn't she? When we talk about where are those credits coming from, right? And you look at the overall tax structure. What would you say, Ben? Is she correct about that?
I think she's partially correct because, again, we talked about the distribution of Maryland state and local taxes, and we talk about the Maryland state earned income tax credit. When the state forgoes income from some taxpayers, other taxpayers have to pick it up. That's true. On the other hand, I think it's important to recognize that the earned income tax credit is actually a refund to low-income taxpayers on income tax that they are paying. It does not exceed their refund, their income tax that they paid. Here in Maryland, we do have a partially refundable tax for those at the very bottom of the income scale. But for most people that are able to take the earned income tax credit, that is actually paid for through the taxes that they would have paid. They just get to keep instead.
Lorenzo in Baltimore, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
How are you, Dan?
Okay, thanks.
Great show as usual.
Oh, thanks.
My comment is, first of all, let me preface it by saying I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism. I'm a small business owner, and I live every day with the concept of it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. However, that said, I also understand that, without government, I wouldn't have this awesome infrastructure that I have to, private business doesn't build roads. They didn't invent the internet. Private business didn't do everything that is needed for me to be able to operate my small business on a level playing field with everyone else. So I'm more inclined to agree with President Obama's tax policy and also the tax policy of a progressive. But I have a question to your guest, and because I haven't been able to answer this question, I can't think of any fiscal policy, whether it be taxation, legislation, or whatever. I can't think of anything within the last 40 years that the conservative agenda has come up with that has worked for the entire country. I can't think of one policy that has benefited everyone. Can your guests think of anything at all? Maybe inform me that there's something out there that I may be missing.
When it comes to economic policy and budgets, I was about to ask you about the Bush era tax cuts that President Obama signed on to extend, not to let expire. I forget when that was, December 2011, maybe. So we still have a lot of those in place, right? And the president now is actually talking about what would amount to or constitute repeal of some of the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. What about Bush-era tax cuts? Where are you on that, Ben? Did we see a benefit from those?
Yeah, so, to partially answer the caller's question, I can't speak to every single policy that the Republican Party has proposed.
Yeah.
I will say that I think we get good ideas from all sides, sometimes more from one side than the other and sometimes less. But, for example, we've been talking about the earned income tax credit, and that's been something that, in fact, you've seen people like Congressman Ryan really promote as a positive program. Now, I would disagree with Congressman Ryan in his efforts to eliminate the minimum wage and promote the earned income tax credit as the single alternative. I think both of those programs are really important. We need both. It's kind of like we need nuts and bolts. They help people. They help families in different ways. When we're talking about the Bush era tax cuts, they clearly did not have the impact they were sold as having. Most of the benefits went to those with incomes between $200,000 and $500,000. And because they went to high-income households, the tax savings didn't go into local economies. We talked about this earlier.
Right.
When the very rich get a tax break, they're as likely to take a trip around the world as they are to.
But the argument was that they were going to create jobs because the very rich are investing companies. They own companies. They're going to create jobs.
Companies create jobs when there are customers for what they sell. And if their customers don't have more money, then it's hard to create jobs. I really, when we look back at that first decade of the 21st century, I have to say, economically speaking, that was not a great decade for the vast majority of American families. It's sad to say, but I think the housing bubble and the deficit spending on the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were some of the economic highlights of that decade, and that didn't really trickle down to either didn't trickle down to families, or it had negative impacts further down the road.
Again, Ben Orr, executive director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. Andy in Baltimore has a question for Ben. Go right ahead, Andy. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering why the discussion is always about just percentages of income that go to taxes and not about the amounts paid. If I drive a 20-year-old Ford or a brand new Mercedes, I take up the same space when I park. And it seems to me that's true of a lot of what the services we get are from government. There's never any mention about the amounts paid. Why is that?
Percentage has more meaning to me personally as I look at this. I'm no expert, certainly not an economist. Andy's arguing. I didn't quite get his car analogy, but he's arguing because the rich pay in total so much more than others. But I keep looking at the proportions, you know, the percentages. And
so percentages allow us to make comparisons.
Sure.
For one thing. And I think it's really important to do that because one of the values that we have as a state is that we ask more from, you know, for the most part, we ask more from those who are able to pay more. And it may be true that that car, whether it's a Mercedes or a pickup truck, takes up the same amount of space on the road. On the other hand, the person who can afford a Mercedes, and hopefully we all can someday, has benefited more from government services than perhaps the person owning the pickup truck. That may not be true. I certainly enjoyed driving my pickup truck when I had it. And so preference plays a part in that as well. But when we had the previous caller who was the small business person, and he talked about how his small business has benefited from the transportation infrastructure that our taxes pay for, the legal system that our taxes pay for, the education that his future employees receive is really important to the successful, to whether or not his business is successful. All those sorts of things really add up. And so it is not just that we want to look at the dollar value, but it's really a question of who has benefited more from our economy and how much of our economy is supported by
state government. I don't know about that argument, Ben. How do you argue that somebody driving Mercedes necessarily benefited more from the economy or the infrastructure of the state than someone driving a pickup truck? I don't follow that. What if you said to me, if you were a wealthy person who said to me, you know how much I paid in taxes last year to the state of Maryland? $340,000. And I would say, well, that's a lot of money, but, you know, what's the rest of the story? What percentage of your income is that? Where did it leave you? That's what I would ask him. That makes more sense to me.
All very good questions. And I think perhaps we should move away from the car analogy and talk more about
income. Yeah, I didn't like it to begin with.
Income as general. But, you know, I think it's – let me give you another example. When we talk about corporate taxation, for example, you know, Ernst & Young has done this study for the last couple of years where they look at what corporations get back in terms of in comparison to what they pay in taxes. And Ernst & Young actually finds that not only do corporations in Maryland get back more in taxes in benefits than they pay in taxes, they get more than corporations in any other state, and they actually get more back in benefits than they pay in taxes. For every dollar they put in, they get $1.15 back in benefits.
In Maryland.
In terms of, because we have such a highly educated workforce, because we have such great transportation networks, we have such a great higher education system. It's really, you know, Maryland is a great place to work,
well,
to grow up.
That's not what the new governor says. You know, he's got a sign up now saying we're open for business as if we weren't before. Based on what you're saying, it sounds like we were.
According to Ernst & Young, we're doing pretty well. According to studies on innovation, we're doing well. And
let's take a quick call. Greg in Owings Mills. Greg, we're down to one. You got 1 minute. Greg, go ahead.
So I liked the O'Malley administration's priorities, generally speaking, on spending, although the increase in the sales tax concerned me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in what your guests would say, instead of closing the gap with budget cuts, how could we do it if we needed to raise more revenue? How would he recommend doing it?
I think that's a great question. And what I would say is that we do need a balanced approach that includes revenues to meet our growing needs, not a cuts-only approach. In fact, any tax proposal, would also say, should be evaluated based on the charts that we've been talking about today in terms of who pays taxes in
mm-hmm.
Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that the tax plan Marylanders deserve would help those taxpayers in the middle who currently pay the most, while asking those at the top who currently pay the least as a share of their income to put in a little bit more. I think there will be some alternative proposals coming out of the legislature that do just that.
Really? Well, we'll look
for
that.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Thank you, Ben. Come back and visit us again, would you?
Absolutely.
Good information here. Thank you very much. Ben Orr, Executive Director of the Maryland Center on Economic Policy. You can find more information about their recent reports on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, and make sure you check out that chart that we've been talking about. We'll take a break here. This is the end of our first hour. A short break, and then hour number two of Midday is coming along. Friday's lunch is provided by Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood. at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. Please stay tuned for the news. I'll see you after that for the second hour.